ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's not something you think will happen in your backyard until it does. Driven by a number of factors, including climate change, the places where we live and work are increasingly vulnerable. In some cases, the ground itself is giving way. Streets, homes, whole neighbourhoods slipping bit by bit until eventually they are underwater. Rafa Athala knows just how quickly that can happen.
After work, I'm just going to the gym. It's a 15-minute walk from my place. Once I get to the gym, it starts raining really heavily, and then I just stay there for around an hour. And then once I go out, it basically just flooded already. Just 1 hour, it can just get massively flooded. I waited for an hour and a half, kind of realized that the flooding won't disappear anytime soon. So I just basically braved myself and just walk through. It was knee deep.
This is a dark episode. There's no getting around that. But it's also about what comes next. Worldwide, more than 6 million square kilometres of land is slowly sinking. To put that into perspective, that's roughly the combined size of India, Argentina and Japan, affecting nearly 2 billion people. Today on By Design, how do you design your way out of a sinking city? Land subsidence is when the ground beneath our feet starts to sink, often because people are extracting too much groundwater. When water is taken from the ground for drinking, farming, or industry, the tiny spaces in the soil collapse and the land above gradually sinks. Combine this with rising sea levels, and many coastal cities around the world are in trouble. Jakarta is the fastest sinking city, losing as much as 200 millimetres per year, with the north of Jakarta experiencing the greatest impact. Rafa Athala is an ABC journalist born and raised in Jakarta, and he's covered the areas worst affected with land subsidence. His story is not easy to hear.
It's really, really more drastic than I ever realized. And what differentiates most Jakartans from the people who lives in these coastal villages are that the ground, you can actually see the ground sinking. So every year, Jakarta sinks around a few centimeters every year. But if you live in the city, you really don't experience it that much. For them, you really, really experience it. So they have to build up almost every year. And for people who are privileged enough, who can build every year on top of the ground, you know, that would be fine. But when we get to the coastal village, most of the people there aren't economically able to raise their houses. So for one of the housing, I remember just coming in and then we have to bow our heads and then step down in order to get to inside of their house, and it's a few centimeters deep. When walking in the villages as well, I noticed that there's a window, and this window, when I was talking to the people there, it used to be a few years ago, it was around 1 meter above ground, but now it's fully submerged in the ground. So it goes to show how, you know, in a few years, it's already been sinking really drastically.
More than 11 million people call Jakarta home. It's a city sinking beneath its own weight, and one still trying to plan ahead. Bang Bang Susantono is an urban planning and infrastructure specialist and the former head of Indonesia's new capital authority. He says Jakarta is unlike any other sinking city on Earth.
One is the excessive groundwater extraction, but also because Jakarta experienced a heavy or a high rate of urbanization. So most of the people at the bottom of the pyramids, usually they try to reside in what we call the informal sector. So the different situation between Jakarta and other developed cities is that we have to deal also with the informal settlement and informal economy. And that makes the complexity is higher than the others, you know. It's not only about technology, it's not only about engineering. It's also about how we will try to combat poverty, for example. Because informal sector and poverty are like a two sides of a coin. We must also deal with both of them.
So are you suggesting then with all the informal settlements in Jakarta, they're drawing water from underneath the city, from the aquifer underneath Jakarta, and that's the real cause of the city itself sinking?
Not only them, but also the excessive extraction of groundwater from the many industries, many hotels, many big buildings and stuff like that. But for them, it's a matter of survival for the poor, right? So we have to make the water services for them. Number one is available, of course. Second one is reliable. And the third one is affordable. Because otherwise, they also will struggle to have the pipe water services. Jakarta officially has about 81% coverage, officially. But, you know, in reality, if you go to that fisherman village in the coastal area of Jakarta, you can just easily see that they are really depends on these informal water services. That is more expensive, actually, from the pipe water services. There is one actions by the government of Jakarta trying to control, quote-unquote, the water extractions by having, you know, some inspections to the big building, high-rise buildings in Jakarta. And they find that most of them are using the well to extract the water. And that's really also a contribute to the land subsidence in Jakarta.
It does sound a lot like the people in Jakarta, and particularly the ones near the coast that you're describing there, are getting used to living with the land level sinking, the sea levels rising, fresh water is scarce, poverty is everywhere, and this is the complexity of the problem that we're facing right now. Is that about sum it up?
Yes, that's correct. We know exactly, Anthony, for example, that technology is available around the world, right? We see the Netherlands. Perhaps we can also have some example from Venice, also from Tokyo, for example. But in the case of Jakarta, we have to deal with all the informality as well. And that makes a little bit complex and difficult for the technology and engineering to work properly.
Are you noticing things like a rise in the increase of waterborne diseases and those sorts of, I guess, hygiene issues or sanitation issues?
Yes, the wash issue, water supply, sanitation, hygiene, we call it wash, I think is very imminent in the northern coastal area of Jakarta. And this is also one area that they are not trying to tackle at this moment. Of course, when you cannot make the flooding because of the high tide disappear, then this kind of problem will come back again in every rainy season, for example. It's a multiple-pronged approach the government must take at this point. It's not only about developing some structure, for example, like a polder system, but also on how you will develop the community that is resilience to this kind of situations. And while the government trying to tackle the problem, they must adapt to this kind of situation by lifestyle that make them easier in trying to tackle these situations.
This is ABC Radio National's By Design. I'm Anthony Burke. The informal settlements Bang Bang is referring to are home to some of Jakarta's poorest residents, living in the kampungs, long-established urban villages. In much of the city's north, basic government infrastructure has never fully arrived, including access to safe, clean piped water. These communities are grappling with chronic water scarcity on the one hand, and increasingly, regular flooding on the other. Alisa Sutanajaya is the executive director of the Rujak Center for Urban Studies in Jakarta, and she has worked closely with communities across the city's northern kampungs.
The community in North Jakarta, it's divided into poor neighborhood, live in the informal settlements called kampung, and also you have this gated community where rich people live. But regarding flooding, both communities affected, but on the different scale. The informal kampung, because they are poor and also the infrastructure is also degraded. So the flooding there, of course, caused them severe damage daily, but they also adapt very quickly.
For families living in the kampungs, there's often nowhere else to go. As the ground beneath their homes slowly sinks, those who can afford it build upwards. Those who can't do what they've always done, mop up, dry out and carry on. Along Jakarta's northern edge, a coastal seawall already stretches around 46 kilometres. And there are plans for something much larger, a 40-kilometre offshore barrier across Jakarta Bay, part of the so-called Giant Seawall Project. But, as Alisa explains, the existing wall doesn't always protect the communities it was meant to save.
So the seawall is kind of like trapped the water. If you ask about what happened in their daily life during the flooding, sometimes the flooding is not coming from the sea. It's coming from behind the neighborhood or even underneath their houses, because the seawall actually kind of like trapped the water to go outside to the sea. You know, you have to depend on pump, and not all the neighborhood have pump. So that's what happens when I said that some infrastructure make their life become more difficult if the flooding come. It takes longer time for water to subside or to gone, entirely gone or dry. Another thing, sometimes the water also get trapped inside their houses because the government keep increasing the road, make their houses below the road elevation. So the water going through inside their houses.
Wow, okay. We know that land subsidence comes from the extraction of groundwater. So how much of the problem is the poor in the north of Jakarta digging wells to access water? Is that what's causing some of this subsidence?
Actually, no, because the one that caused the subsidence is deep groundwater extraction. The poor can only dig up the well until like 5 to 6 meters below. Other than that, it will be too expensive for them. But then the water quality within like 5 to 6 meters is already like contaminated. All the poor that I know, they buy the water from the water vendors. They don't have a water pipe running through, circulating the water inside their house, so they have to buy it. So they don't use the underground water. So rather, the one that who use the deep ground water is usually industry, and especially the fishing industry as well, who also located alongside the north coast of Jakarta.
One of the biggest drivers of Jakarta's sinking ground is the city's reliance on groundwater extraction. As water is pumped out from below, the land above slowly collapses. But there's a growing school of thought that argues this process can be reversed. The idea is called a sponge city, an approach to urban design that helps cities absorb, store and replenish water rather than drain it away. Dr. Tamil Salvimari is an associate professor in the School of Architecture at Taylor's University in Malaysia. She's studied sponge cities and other design-led responses to land subsidence, looking at how urban form itself can become part of the solution.
The sponge city comes in where we have to have more permeable surfaces where it can actually absorb, infiltrate and recharge the water itself. And there are ways how you can do that by collecting the water. Basically, there's designs, or you come up with designs to collect the water. And especially during heavy rain, you collect and you just keep them in a pond. You create a retention pond. That's why we have retention ponds around, especially heavy development areas where we develop for towns or townships. So in Jakarta, they are introducing these kinds of designs to actually collect the water and then release the water after a heavy rain, so that some water is absorbed back onto the earth around the building itself. And some of it is the collected water, yeah, and some of it is released back to the sea or to the nearest river after the rain subsides or the rain stops, so that it doesn't flood, so that we can prevent flood, especially after a very heavy rain or storm, a stormy day.
So that's like recharging the aquifer through that sponge city idea. What other design ideas, especially about a building's weight, are being talked about at the moment?
So basically, we can look into buildings. Lightweight material might help in terms of reducing, especially the dead load of the building itself, because much of the dead weight or the dead load of the building, it comes from the structure or the materials that we use. So there is a lot of cutting edge materials that's much lighter to the traditional materials that we use. A lot of buildings now, especially high rise buildings, if you take examples led by like countries like Singapore, they are also going for timber, which is long lasting. At the same time, it is much lighter and it's more environmental, because traditionally we use concrete structures and concrete bricks, which are very heavy in terms of the weight of the building itself. And then I think we should push for lighter buildings by pushing the limits of certain materials. And of course, I would say concentrated development in the city should be reduced also. Some minimum distance between the cities, especially one city to another, the distance between the cities to be sustainable should be more than 40 kilometers. But the concentrated developments around a major city is happening nowadays, and that's causing more issues to these cities, the main cities now itself, because the suburbs are becoming beyond suburbs. They are trying to match up with the urban areas as well, with much of developments with high-rise buildings.
And Salvi, what about the nature-based options that are being talked about? Things like planting more mangroves, for example, rather than building seawalls. Is this a good strategy? Is this getting more airtime, this kind of discussion?
I'm not sure about getting more airtime, but that is an excellent strategy. Nothing works better than nature itself. What we have been doing is that not only in Jakarta, but also in many other parts of other countries, when they start building, especially nearby the coastal areas, and where we should actually try to make sure we protect this shoreline, especially with the natural wall that is the mangrove, with its network of solid, extremely tangled root, they are able to protect our shoreline. And then they work better because they go deep down and then they can actually trap all the sediments and build natural wall itself. So in future, what we should look into is that basically, I know there's a lot of materials to protect the shoreline now that actually mimics, we call it mimicry, eco-mimicry, biomimics, the natural species, that's mangrove itself. But nothing works like the nature because she goes deep in.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's By Design. I'm Anthony Burke. So far, the ideas on the table are practical and even hopeful. Sponge cities that replenish groundwater by storing and absorbing rain. Lighter construction, timber instead of concrete, reducing the weight cities place on already fragile ground. And the protection or restoration of mangroves, whose deep root systems can buffer coastlines against an encroaching sea. But what about the most radical solution of all? Moving the capital itself. Nusantara was the brainchild of former Indonesian President Joko Widodo, a planned megacity rising from the forests of East Kalimantan on the island of Borneo, about a two-hour flight northeast of Jakarta. Construction is still underway. Bambang Susantono served as chair of the Nusantara Capital Authority, and he argues that while Nusantara may ease the pressure on Jakarta, it can never truly replace it.
Jakarta will always be the financial and economic center of Indonesia. Always. It's like Sydney and Canberra, for example. It's like New York and Washington, for example. Of course, there will be some workload for Jakarta that will be reduced because of the Nusantara. But I think we should not leave Jakarta to tackle this problem by themselves. I think for Indonesia, the financial center of Indonesia will be Jakarta, and we must save Jakarta. And that is why the current administration, I heard, that they try to do their best to accelerate the northern coastal area giant civil projects because of that. So it's very strategic for Indonesia of not to tackle this problem.
Dr. Salvi Mari argues that relocating a capital city isn't just a matter of construction. Cities aren't interchangeable objects. They're made meaningful over generations through memory and culture and everyday life. People form deep attachments to place, and those bonds can't simply be replicated on a new site, no matter how carefully planned. So for Dr. Salvi Mari, the challenge of moving a capital is as much a social and emotional challenge as a physical one.
It has happened before in other countries, but whether they are successful, that is always a question, because when you relocate a capital, we are not talking about the physical assets, not the physical, not the building alone or the job opportunities that potentially can be in Nusantara later. But we are looking at people in Jakarta to move some parts, especially the civil servants and some people who will be working in certain offices. A lot of them will be moving. So I always go back into the sense of belonging. You can move the capital, but you can move the people, we can move the president, but it's very difficult to move the sense of belonging, because sometimes these people even if it is sinking, half of their houses are sinking, they rather build right on top of whatever that is sank, and they rather leave there.
From his vantage point in Jakarta, journalist Rafa Athala is constantly returning to the issue of Nusantara, the planned new capital that looms over conversations about Indonesia's future development and political direction.
Is it a good idea? You know what I'll say? I think for most people see this, you know, in our current timing, it's not the best plan ever. Because building a whole new capital city, and they coined the term, they want it to be a mega city, right? Building a new capital city in the middle of nowhere will take so much funding. It costs billions of dollars. And it comes from taxpayers' money, right? For the most part. And then it takes up funding from essential areas in the government, such as education, for instance. Whereas, you know, there are essential services that we really need right now. So for the most part, I think a lot of people are doesn't like the Nusantara effect because of that one, because the government have to, they have like an efficiency cuts a few months ago, and a couple of essential services were cut down the budget, and we expect it because of Nusantara. And is it happening now? We reach out to the government, and, you know, the current president, Prabowo, said it is happening. Although it has been really vague recently. The Nusantara plan was made from the past president, which is Joko Widodo. And when it was his term, we've seen a large communication about, you know, how Nusantara is doing, what's the progress like, etc., etc. But for Prabowo, it's definitely much more quieter. So it seems vague on our end as well of, okay, is it happening? Yes, they said it's been continued, but we're in the dark. But it is happening, the government said. I don't think anyone has a sense of urgency kind of like that. But I can kind of sort of see what will be the tipping point. So at the moment, we're seeing the drastic sinking on the coastal part of North Jakarta, right? But based on research that we did for the article, the ground that is sinking the most is actually South Jakarta. South Jakarta is, you know, inland, right? So North Jakarta, unfortunately, gets the brunt of South, you know, the cause from South Jakarta. If it keeps on sinking and sinking and sinking, eventually Central Jakarta will also flood. So the seawater from the Java Sea will trickle down to Central Jakarta. And if it trickles down to Central Jakarta, which is the business area of Jakarta, because most people work there, that'll become a really big problem. At the moment, we don't see the coastal flooding from North Jakarta going to Central Jakarta. But if the problem keeps on happening, a lot of experts say that will eventually happen. And that will probably be the tipping point.
Bang Bang Susantono believes the challenge isn't a lack of research, it's a lack of connection. The data on flooding, land subsidence, and sea level rise exists, but too often it never reaches the ordinary Jakartans in a way that feels relevant to their daily lives. For him, the gap between expert knowledge and lived experience is critical. Without clearer, more accessible communication, even the best research risks remaining abstract. And without public understanding, it's far harder to build the collective support needed for long-term solutions.
I think we must also do a lot of public awareness campaigns so that the public can also push and also create the sense of urgency of this matter, right? Because otherwise, it will also not being prioritized by the government, right? That's a normal everywhere in the cities, you know? So the sense of urgency is there. I think the political will must be also being pushed so that it will be put on the priority list of all the menu of the government program in the future. Because Jakarta is one of the centers, not only for me, it's not only for Indonesia, but also for the Southeast Asia.
Bang Bang Susantono, former chairman of the Nusantara Capital Authority. It's a wicked problem. There are design solutions that can help slow and perhaps even halt Jakarta's descent. Or you can try to relieve the pressure on one city by building another. But movement, belonging and trust can't be engineered so easily. The challenge is enormous, but one thing is clear. Abandoning Jakarta is not an option, and whatever path emerges here may well shape how other cities across our region and around the world face a future of rising seas, sinking land and a changing climate. And closer to home, if this is something your community is already living with, land sinking, water rising or coastal erosion, we'd love to hear how you're responding and what's being done where you are. You've been listening to By Design. Follow the podcast to catch future episodes and listen out for our bonus series, Extraordinary Everyday, released every Thursday. Next time on By Design, it's time for a bit of razzle dazzle.
So there was a milkshake that was, it was probably about as tall as a house, and it covered probably, I don't know, like 5% of how big the actual stage was. And that's for scale, yeah, it was a massive stage.
How do you even begin designing for something as spectacular as Eurovision? Join me for that next time on By Design. Because in a rapidly changing world, design matters. The producer of By Design is Siobhan Hunt. This program was produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.